You are listening to Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, episode 21 for Tuesday, May 3rd, 2022. This is JJ Sefton with CBD. And once again, returning to join the scrum and the fray is our friend and author, and seems to be sinking in his seat there. But nonetheless, he's a valuable pundit in the conservative blogosphere, the great Michael Walsh from thepipeline.org. Gentlemen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you two both.
Well, some things are happening that are just surprised us this morning. We're going to get into the whole Ministry of Truth nonsense a little bit later on, but this does touch upon it. It's the leak from the Supreme Court of the United States, evidently indicating that this one case before the court regarding abortion is going to basically repeal Roe versus Wade. But the issue is just the absolute unprecedented nature of this. This never happens before, and it's a complete political hit job in putting this out there to sort of not only just gin up the lackluster Democrat base, but also potentially violence against the justices on the court who may be voting in this decision that would overturn Roe versus Wade. And it's just shocking.
Well, it is shocking because of the diminution of the Supreme Court, but that's been going on for years. Roberts is ruling over a court that has embarrassed itself on so many different occasions that this is not a surprising turn of events. But I do have to correct you. This is not unprecedented. Leaks have occurred in the past. You know, obviously, we haven't seen any significant leaks in many, many years. So this is quite a shock. But I know in the 19th century, it happened. I don't know how many times it happened, but I know that it happened several times. That being said, whether it's illegal or simply a breach of legal ethics, I simply can't answer that. But I think it speaks to the diminished quality of our Supreme Court and by extension, the rest of the legal structure in the United States.
Well, it's interesting that Roberts is the Michael Corleone of the Supreme Court. He was so determined to save his family, he destroyed it. And so now this whiny little weasel excreces from the bowels of the Bush administration, one of GWB's last gifts to the American people, and a permanent one, unfortunately, for quite some time. He's managed to destroy the court by his insistence on the integrity of the court. And now he's got nothing. The rumor is that it came from a clerk in Sotomayor's office. You know, we'll see whether that turns out to be true or not. And CBD, you're right. I've been reading that apparently the original Roe decision was even leaked before it was formally announced by the Supreme Court. Look, the left obsesses on the court for one reason only. All they need is one vote to get their agenda implemented. If they can win 5-4 decisions, they will take that and lose the White House and the Congress and everything else for as long as it takes, because they understand that's the means to power in the United States, that the court seizure via Marbury versus Madison of supreme judicial and any kind of authority has left it open to the fact that all you need is that one vote. So we're reaping the whirlwind of Justice Marshall's very bad decision back in the early 19th century that could be overturned by Congress if there was a Congress, just as the federal judiciary could be abolished by Congress if there was a Congress. The only constitutional court is the Supreme Court, and its powers are very, very limited according to Article 3 of the Constitution. And all the other courts are ordained by Congress in its wisdom. So the courts could be reined in if they wanted to rein them in, but they don't. They'd rather pack them and make sure that they can rule by judicial fiat.
It also provides a significant amount of power to people like Mitch McConnell, you know, the whore from Kentucky. And I'm sure that he is certainly unwilling to give up that control over their little tight minority that has an outside influence, an outsized influence over the choice of justices. I'm sorry, not justices, but judges. Rather, federal
right.
judges.
Well, you know, you know, Michael touched upon George W. Bush inflicting Roberts on us, and Roberts being this Michael Corleone character who wants to save the family by destroying himself and destroying his family. But I don't know what he's trying to save. I mean, when you just look at the one decision that he made with Obamacare,
yeah,
where he basically, you know, that thing was tossed. It was gone because the individual mandate, as we all know, is unconstitutional. The government cannot compel you, or in theory, it cannot compel you to buy a product or service. But instead of just saying, you know, saying this is unconstitutional, throwing it back to Congress to rewrite the law, which means it would never be rewritten by that time, time, I think, because the balance had changed or something or other, and they had said it was not a tax. It was something that was a fine or something like that. And Roberts took a red pen and literally overtly legislated from the bench and wrote law on the bench. And it was at that point, I think, Scalia's head exploded, and that's what led to him dying, because he had originally written the majority opinion, tossing it, and then he had to go in and rewrite it to a minority opinion. But that alone was just, you know, I don't see how this guy has any integrity whatsoever. Yeah, people talk about, well, they're blackmailing him over, you know, supposedly some hinky shenanigans with his adoption of his child, or because he might have had a first-class ticket on the Epstein Express to Pedo Island. But all this stuff, it's meaningless, because his character is such that he is part and parcel, I think, of... It could be just as simple as he wants to be part of the cocktail set and doesn't want to be excluded. It could be that shallow. Yeah. But other than that, he's a globalist.
Yeah, and he's not a globalist. He's nothing more than a legal lightweight and a political hack. He's an apparatchik of the deep state, and he knows how to consolidate his limited power within the court. But, you know, great justices are few and far between. We have one on the court right now.
We do indeed. And Justice Thomas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite people, and we lost one. With Scalia. Alito is a reliable conservative voice. He believes in limited government. He believes in the ridiculous, outmoded document, the Constitution. I don't know that he is a legal scholar. I don't know that he is a heavyweight, but he certainly votes the way I would like to vote.
Apparently, this opinion is extremely well-reasoned. I've just been reading up on it. I have not read the opinion yet myself, but from the chorus of lawyers on the Glenn Reynolds site, they all seem to be praising it quite highly. And I think basically Roberts, who knows what the ulterior motive is, but there doesn't have to be. He may just be a weak little man. And I think that's exactly what he is. And unfortunately, American history and world history is filled with. He's the Franz von Papen of the American Supreme Court. JJ, I know you'll like that reference. So I do. I like to throw in a Nazi-era reference just whenever we can get the pot boiling here. But.
You know, why not? Because, you know, there's Nazis everywhere. So why don't we have some legitimate Nazis in there to flavor the Hassenpfeffer of this wonderful Gemütlichkeit of insanity. My German is failing me.
You know, what fascinates me about the supposed overturning of Roe v. Wade is the hysteria that's being ginned up by the left.
And
they're very good at this. And yeah, but the reality is, let's face it, this is a Supreme Court holding that may be overturned. This does nothing to the states to limit their power to legislate about abortion. You know, before Roe v. Wade, there were states where you could get an abortion.
Yes.
And there were states that you could not. And after Roe v. Wade, if hopefully it is overturned, that will be the law of the land. You know, federalism ain't such a bad idea.
Well, you know,
and that's what we're going to have.
No, it's just a restoration of the status quo ante. Sorry to interrupt you, but that's all that it is. And then you have a choice of whatever your state votes for. It goes back to the people. I don't see how the left can object to that, but of course they can object to everything because they want the way they want it, and that's it.
What's absolutely freaking infuriating is that they scream about us with states' rights. It's always used to smear, you know, conservatives in the Ninth and Tenth Amendment. Meanwhile, they have sanctuary cities and sanctuary states, and then when Trump was trying to put his agenda forward, they say, no, that doesn't apply in our state. So all of a sudden, they want it both ways, nine ways till Sunday, as you know, Chuck Schumer would say for something else. But no, I mean, it's like, it's funny, it's disgusting that they'll blast us for that, and then they'll hide behind it at the same time. So it's great. The Constitution is both a shield and a cudgel, whether it's a legitimate putting forth of the Ninth and Tenth Amendment or not, but that's what they'll claim. And then all of a sudden, when you call them on that, they'll say, we don't know what you're talking about.
Well, they only want one thing, and that's power, and they're very good at going after it. On the other hand, I do think that we've got them on the run in many ways right now, and that may also contribute to their absolute hair-on-fire hysteria about this. They don't like to lose. I mean, they really are the bully that doesn't like to get punched in the face. And did you love seeing Mike Tyson carry around a book by Tom Sowell the other day? I mean, was that... Is this a great country or what? I mean, now I'm going to dump Tulsi from my 2024 ticket and go with DeSantis Tyson. Don't fuck with Mike, man. He'll set you down on your butt pretty quick.
Shouldn't that be DeSantis and Tyson? Well, for
DeSantis.
Yeah, DeSantis.
But no, that is amazing that he cites Thomas Sowell. I mean, you know, so whoever got that book in his hand is, you know, great. I'm hopefully he reads it, and not to imply that Mike Tyson is an imbecile, but you know, who knows? You know, is that he's reading that or that he has that in his hand? It's pretty. It must absolutely drive the left crazy. You know,
Can you imagine Iron Mike presiding over the Senate? You know, he'd come in and say, "Everybody has a plan until they get hit in the mouth."
Exactly.
The vote is unanimous
Well, you know, well, that was Elon Musk in a way, you know, hitting everybody, and whatever you think of it is his motives. But he sure was, you know, sounding, making all the right noises about free speech and about free enterprise and going after Pocahontas Warren. And so, look, I give him credit for doing it. And it's, again, it knocks them back on their heels. The whole Loudoun County school thing and, you know, the revolt against critical crackpot jive-comp theory, speaking of German.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
You know, and all these things, and transsexualism, these are knocking them back on their heels, and this is the way to be. So
let's not pretend that just because they're back on their heels that they are going to stop fighting.
Oh, of course
they're
not.
No.
Good.
They'll keep fighting.
Rid of alternative modes to get what they want. They overstepped their bounds, and we've discussed it in the past. They've overstepped with transgenderism. They've overstepped with these crackpot racial theories, but they're going to get them in the schools if we do not stay extraordinarily vigilant.
Yeah, there are some other good signs. I think not only Musk, I think Musk went into this kind of as a lark, but as you know, here he was Time Magazine Man of the Year, as we used to call it when I worked for Time Magazine, when it was a real magazine. And now he's public enemy number one as far as the left is concerned, almost overnight. And I think he's starting to react to the fact that these people really hate you when you go over to the other side or when you're perceived to have changed sides. So he's getting an awakening, and all of his tweets since then have been to pull the tail of the tiger, as he tweeted just the other day. There's that. There's the fact that the Obamas got dumped from their whatever. What was that? Some podcast
Spotify?
They were doing?
They're on Spotify.
Spotify.
Yeah.
Right. Netflix stock is cratered, and they just offloaded the imbecile prince of Das Haus des Sachse-Coburg und Gotha. Yeah, that's the British family. We had to change the name at the time of the unpleasantness of the First World War because they didn't want the British to think we were Germans, which we are. Well, of course we are.
Before he was shackled to Markle. When he was a kid, he went to a costume party dressed up as Schickel Gruber, and he caught all kinds of hell for it. Remember that?
He's not the brightest bulb in the chandelier, and that's a very low chandelier.
Oh, it's a very very inbred low chandelier. Yeah. But you know, they got dumped by Netflix. Netflix stock is cratering. A lot of these lefty organizations, Disney, of course, is Exhibit A of what happens to you when you actually cross somebody who fights back. There's a lot of encouraging things, but you're right. They'll never give up. You got to put them down and in the ground before they stop fighting.
Yeah, there was actually an article that I saw today, everything gets lost in the sauce when I do the morning report. I have like 100 links, and all of this is like, you know, on top.
Yeah, I don't know how you do it. It's amazing.
Volume. I don't know how I do it either, but there was one that was a report that I think it was either from City Journal or maybe it was from City Journal or one of the, maybe the Washington Free Beacon, that union membership in private sector unions is cratering. It's absolutely, you know, a lot of that is also speak of the Supreme Court. Maybe it's an offshoot of the Janus decision, which, you know, which was amazing in and of itself. But that's another sign that all of these things are, there's something moving. There's definitely a movement going on. But you are so right, CBD and Michael, in that, as my mother of blessed memory used to say, evil never rests. And you have to be, we have to use this to be eternally vigilant and warn people, look what they're doing to your children. Look what they're doing to your bank accounts. Look what they're doing to the country. Never let these people anywhere near the levers of power again.
That's the truth. Evil is a concept that's gone out of fashion, but I've put it in the last three books I've written, starting with The Devil's Pleasure Palace, is that my little, before I got kicked off Twitter, I was an early kickoff of, kick. What would the noun form of being kicked off Twitter be? But kick I was an early adopter of being kicked off Twitter. But I used to always write, they never stop, they never sleep, they never quit. And when you understand that about the left, then and only then can you deal with them. Because at no point did they say, you're right, we got beat, we quit, we're going home. At no point do they.
Well, you know, this is, as I think I said yesterday in my column, it's when you look at history not as events that are isolated events, but as a continuum. This has been going on for, you know, well, you said Marbury versus Madison. Maybe that was the beginning of it, but certainly the Civil War and for sure the Wilson administration. So it's at least 100 years of this period of turning America upside down and turning it into something that it was never meant to be. And it goes hand in hand with all the crazy progressivism and socialism that was happening in Europe post-World War I or leading up to World War I and then in the aftermath, which begat, as we said, Mr. Schicklgruber and everything else and Mr. Stalin and Mao. So here we are.
Well, as some college student apparently said one day after learning about World War I, oh, now I understand why they call it World War II. In other words, he finally realized it was the sequel, you know?
Exactly.
But you were absolutely right yesterday that we don't teach history as a continuum. I just did Last Stands, which was a series of battles all illustrating what men do in extremists, which is fight to the end. But in the new book I'm writing, which will be out next year, it's called A Rage to Live, A Time to Die. And it is this tracing of history from the beginning. So I'm starting with the Trojan War and showing how the great commanders of battles that are turning points in history are all the same guy, basically. You can go from Alexander to Patton and draw an absolutely straight line in terms of the characteristics of those commanders, the way they saw the battlefield, their ability to see 10 minutes ahead in a kinetic way. I use Clausewitz as the kind of analytical tool for all of these things. But if you don't understand the continuity of history, and the left doesn't want you to understand that, they have this idea of an arc bending towards some kind of totalitarian justice. If you don't understand history, then you tend to see these things in isolation, and then you don't understand them. That's the larger point here.
What they have done with the destruction of the academy over the last 50 years feeds right into that point. If they don't teach history in colleges, then these kids simply don't know history. So they have nothing to base their interpretations of current events on. They can't look back to, you know, to Marbury versus Madison because none of them know what the fuck that is.
No, correct. And as I said about the Ukraine war, I'd feel more comfortable if I thought one person in the State Department had read War and Peace, read a poem of Pushkin, or seen Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin on stage at the Opera House. If you'd done any of those three things, you'd have a sense of who the Russians are, but of course they don't.
The vast ignorance of our media and our government about the Russian psyche is embarrassing. You know something? I'm not a Russian scholar by any means, but as you say, read some fucking Russian authors. That will teach you more about what Vladimir Putin is thinking today than anything you can read in the New York Times and the Washington Post. Read their short stories, read their novels, read a little bit of their history, which is a complex thing. But they can't. They can't do that. What they want to do is obviously drive the narrative because for whatever reason, Ukraine is their new, you know, freedom fighting, scrappy little, let's get the Russian bear group. And let's face it.
The only reason why they want to go after Russia is because they associate Russia with Donald Trump. Vladimir Putin equals Donald Trump because they've been spoon-fed this big lie that Trump and Putin colluded to steal the 2016 election and they wanted to steal the 2020 election or whatever that is. And of course, this has been completely exploded. But the thing is, you've sort of whipped people into a frenzy into associating Donald Trump with Vladimir Putin for no reason whatsoever. And this is what you get. But, you know, back to what you both of you were talking about and just the ignorance of the people who are in power in this country and sadly too many people who are, you know, the low information set. You go back to the Obama years. They had that. Who was that stupid idiot State Department spokesman or spokesflunky? This guy, Tommy Vitor, when he was pressed on an issue. I don't know if it was about Hillary Clinton and Benghazi. And he said 2 years. That was like 100 years ago, man. And so that's this attitude. Yeah. Or Ben Rhodes, who gloats and who boasts about the fact that here's this guy who's a failed screenwriter, and he's in a position of power in the State Department as a foreign policy advisor, and he's gloating at the fact that he has the press and eating out of the palm of his hand. I mean, because he's just feeding them, spoon-feeding them all kinds of bullshit about what's going on. Not that the press is ever going to be curious enough to press him on it because they're in his pocket. But still, that's what we're dealing with. Total ignorance that's dressed up as people who... What is it? Not Kubler-Ross, but it's Dunning-Kruger. You know, people who think they know everything and they're completely ignorant about everything, and yet they'll come across as we're the experts.
Well, remember, I'm sorry. Go ahead, CBD.
So some dead white guy named George Washington said, and I found this quote a few days ago, if freedom of speech is taken away, then dumb and silent we may be led like sheep to the slaughter. And that speaks exactly to what is going on today, that vast ignorance of everything.
That's Marxist dogma. Remember, with any revolution, you start over, you reset the calendar. The French Revolution threw out all the months of the year, decimalized the days of the week for a while. That didn't work out too good. Everything went back to year zero. The new Soviet man went back to year zero. They have to keep dispensing with the past in order to create the future that they want to create. And our job as conservatives and historians and scholars and activists is to remind people of the past. So I guarantee you most of the young people today think that if Roe v. Wade is overturned, abortion is automatically illegal and they'll all be put to death. That's what they've been told, rather than the way we started this conversation, which is it restores the status quo, and then the states will go forward and make their own laws. And if you don't want to live in Alabama, you can move somewhere else. Well, of course, the Biden administration is trying to prevent that. One of the things that they've always tried to do is cut down on Americans' mobility. So they, using the General Chow's sickness there, they prevented us from traveling. And so they're locking people into these states that they're in. As Steve Bannon was saying this morning, there are no conspiracies, but there certainly are coincidences, and there are no coincidences either. So here we are. I think all of this has been carefully calibrated to move us to a state of discomfort and panic and not knowing where the pillars are to hang on to anymore. We're in a very difficult period in American history.
And we're back. CBD, Michael Walsh, J.J. Sefton here with the Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks podcast. And Michael has a wonderful column, this all of a sudden Ministry of Truth, or I don't even know what the hell it's, the stupid something governance board or misinformation governance bureau, who the hell knows what it is, that has been enacted or is about to be enacted, that's going to monitor our speech, so we make sure we don't say anything bad about sponge brain square depends in the White House.
Yeah, the article is quite interesting, and he starts out with so now the mask has dropped, and for the first time the American people can see the modern left in all its hateful, unadorned, vituperative, spiteful glory. And that's very, very well put, because they are nasty, nasty people, and they hate us. And they've chosen as the head of the Disinformation Governance Board a woman named Nina Jankowicz, who is at once a fascist in the an old school fascist who's quite willing to send us to labor camps, but also a bit of a fucking moron too. She jabbers like a child. She's got the sing-song lilting voice. It sounds like she's sitting around with her dorm mates stoned at 3 a.m. talking about how to fix the world. And all she's doing is pushing those typical ignorant buttons, creating fear. Come to the nanny state. We are here to help. Listen to us. We know better. And, for people who are paying attention, it's a vomit-inducing choice. But as Michael points out, it's a very dangerous choice, too.
Well, it's interesting to me that we don't know anything about this woman. They've scrubbed her from the internet. We don't have any, as I pointed out, just go to her Wikipedia page and it tells you absolutely nothing about her, including what her date of birth is and her place of birth. That seems very odd to me for a public figure. I have a Wikipedia page and it says where I was born and what day I was born and all the basic information. She's 32 or 33 years old. She obviously has no life experience whatsoever. She seems to be quite involved in this plucky little Ukraine narrative, as I like to term it. And she just stinks to high heaven. Sorry, but she does. What's up with that?
Well, it turns out she's, I think a number of years ago, she was a big, big pusher of the Russian collusion disinformation, ironically enough. Yeah, she's an expert on disinformation, mostly because she's the one that's peddling it. You know, the timing, like everything else, is interesting because as we were talking about all of these things caving in on the junta, they keep talking about how wonderful the economy is. And meanwhile, we have stagflation out the wazoo. Gasoline is $10 a gallon or approaching it. We bungled the Afghanistan fiasco, the almost a nuclear deal coming on with Iran, and this war in Ukraine that everybody is hot and horny to get us involved in. Whatever one thinks about Vladimir Putin, and I don't like the guy, or whatever one thinks about Zelensky, and he ain't exactly Haile Selassie or Winston Churchill, as everybody is pimping him to be, there is this hue and cry to get us boots on the ground, toe-to-toe with the Russians, and perhaps have a nuclear exchange with them. But be that as it may, the fact that you now... they're losing control of the narrative, or they think they're losing control of the narrative. So now they're talking about things that are malinformation, disinformation, and misinformation, and they're going to regulate what is and what is not and what is not the truth. And this is just, you know, we were talking about the evil nature of the left, and they really are evil, but at least it was sort of within the confines of playing, you know, in the ball field of the legislature, or maybe broader context of the Supreme Court, however, or the judicial system. But here is just something that's like, well, we can't win there, we can't win there, we can't even rig the courts. So what we're going to do is we're going to jail people for spouting a line contrary to what we want people to think. I mean, look what they did with, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, about the parents who objected at school board meetings in Virginia. The White House and the Department of Justice basically colluded together and met and had their own little miniature Wannsee conference, if you will, and decided to label parents as terrorists and insurrectionists. So because they're objecting to what's being taught to their children. So this is really, if you are not frightened by this, then as we said before, you're not aware of history, which is exactly what they don't want you to be. They don't want you to be aware of history. So we've seen this before in every totalitarian regime down the line. And so when it comes here, people will think, oh, it's a good thing. We got a silent city. It's like liars like Trump or liars like DeSantis or whomever, or anybody who says that the vaccines are actually causing more deaths than they're curing, or that the masks are ineffective, or that to say all lives matter instead of Black Lives Matter is hate speech, and on and on.
What I'm curious about is exactly what legislative power she's going to be given. What
exactly?
What enforcement power she's going to be given? You know, she, as you mentioned, she was a big fan of the Hunter Biden laptop story as fantasy. Well, in fact, the reality is that the Hunter Biden laptop is 100% real, and you know, hundreds of gigs of data are showing that our current president, ersatz president as he may be, is a crook. He was intimately involved in influence peddling, and in spite of that data, she is going to push that aside as simply disinformation. And that's something that people should be extraordinarily afraid of, because she has a bully pulpit, perhaps not in front of us, but certainly behind the scenes, that is going to be quite powerful. What, as Michael mentioned in his article, is this a coincidence that this woman appears on the national stage the same week that Elon Musk buys Twitter? They see in Elon Musk a very, very dangerous man who is willing to put up $43 billion, whatever the number is, to expand the range of acceptable speech. Now, let's not pretend that Elon Musk is anything other than an opportunist, but he's an opportunist with a sense that free speech is a good thing. For all I know, he's a hard lefty, and his dream is a socialist nirvana in America. But if we get there with free speech, that's a little bit more tolerable than without free speech.
Yeah, I think Musk is in the process of finding himself. He was obviously one of the techno nerds, but he's a kind of a different character. He's born in South Africa. His father left the family quite early, apparently. He went to Canada at some point. He's a kind of globalist by default, but a man who saw the country which he grew up disappear out from underneath him. In this way, he's very similar to Putin. And I don't know how that animates people or motivates people, but I think Musk has got enough sense that he came to this country and realized how great an opportunity it gave him to be. CBD, you mentioned he's an opportunist. You're right. He doesn't invent anything. He sees the possibilities in things. As he said about Twitter, I see possibilities for it. And then puts his money where his mouth is. And he's been smart and lucky. And here he is. I think you're going to see a transformation in him. He reminds me a little bit of Trump in 2016 when people were saying, oh, he's just another lefty Democrat and blah, blah, blah. And I said, shut up and let history work on him. And Trump let us down by never quite being strong enough against the left. He talked a good game, but he didn't deliver on a good game, which is why I'm a big DeSantis fan at this moment, because he actually does things. He doesn't even talk about them before he does them. He just does them. And I think Musk is going to be a pleasant surprise. He may not be a card-carrying conservative, but I think he's certainly better than Zuckerberg or Bezos or Gates or any of these other oligarchs.
You mentioned him as, you know, being a liberal or being whatever he is. You know, it's funny how now some of the, and I don't agree and probably disagree with her on 99.99% of things, Naomi Wolf. She's a dyed-in-the-wool, you know, liberal feminist. And here she is. She is one of the most staunch advocates out there for free speech and for free expressions from all sides. Same thing with Glenn Greenwald and the same thing with Matt Taibbi.
Do I
personally agree with them on issues, you know, in and of themselves? I'm sure I don't. But this is such a crucial issue on being able to not demonize or dehumanize your political opponents and give them a platform and then respect them. Just have the common decency of respect and respect that they have a differing opinion and then debate them in the arena of ideas and let the chips fall where they may. So,
no, there's no, I'm sorry, the First Amendment is clear. Nobody deserves respect. Nobody is entitled to anything other than the ability to speak on whatever forums are available. I owe no one respect, and I will not give it unless I find their ideas to be worthy of respect. But
you'll give them a hearing. You'll give them a hearing.
Exactly. Right?
But that's just it.
JJ means, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
That respect. I keep saying this to people on our side. Take your allies where you find them. I don't care if you don't like Glenn Greenwald. I don't care if you don't like Matt Taibbi. I don't care if you don't like Bill Maher. I don't care if you don't like Naomi Wolf. They're all playing for your team right now, asshole. So why don't you just get with the program?
Bingo. That's exactly it.
We can't afford to alienate people who agree with us on the thing we're talking about, and which I frankly thought that all of my lefty friends used to subscribe to, which was the primacy of the First Amendment and the absolute importance of free speech. And the fact that so many of them have abandoned free speech now that they see their totalitarian dream looming is disheartening. But when we have guys like them, another guy is David Mamet. I'm reading Mamet's new book. Yeah. When I saw American Buffalo and Glengarry Glen Ross, I said, David Mamet is a conservative. He just doesn't know it yet.
Right.
And I felt that way. I met Maher years ago. He's kind of a libertarian who's got a very few issues. But other than that, he's a common sense, nasty comic like so many of them are. These guys sometimes aren't that self-aware until finally they get red-pilled. Naomi Wolf is a very good example. Apparently, she's now on Bannon about every 2 days, right? Talking about...
She was on Tucker Carlson the other day.
And she's on Tucker. Yeah.
She made a really great, and this was amazing. She said, there's no such thing as malinformation. There's no such thing as disinformation. There's only information, and it's up to you as a free individual to sort of get all the information that you can and make an informed opinion based upon what you're reading. And,
right.
You know, not to ban speech, and that right there, and, I mean, this is Naomi Wolf, a dyed-in-the-wool feminist liberal. And
yeah, we forgive her for everything at this point, right?
Yeah, well, that statement should be embroidered on a sampler and put above Home Sweet Home.
I agree. I said that in the lead to my piece we're discussing. I said otherwise, you know, known as a difference of opinion. Yeah. They were trying to criminalize differences of opinion when they are trying to take your tongue away from you. And some idiot at the dead husk of Time magazine the other day was talking about, well, we don't understand the historical roots of free speech. She doesn't understand them. She's never read the essays of Trenchard and Gordon, which they published under the name of Cato in the early 18th century, which were part of the foundational theory of the First Amendment. Benjamin Franklin reprinted them, and they're often attributed to Franklin, but they're not. And one of the things they say is that when a man cannot call his tongue his own, he cannot call anything his own. And that was a very, very important building block to our First Amendment. And a true leftist, a true liberal, not a leftist liberal, will agree with us that that has to be primary in a society. And if those people have now abandoned that, they're no longer a part of our society, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, when you have movement, you know, when you go to the campuses, when someone like a Ben Shapiro, whatever you think of Ben Shapiro or a William Jacobson or somebody goes to speak, and you have these literal thug goons rushing the stage with impunity, because the school, the deans, and no one's going to stop them, and they're not stopped and they're not punished. They rush onto the stage and almost physically assault them, and actually do sometimes physically assault them and run them off of campus. You have that. You have let alone Antifa, let alone all of these things together, and now we have a Ministry of Truth. This is really dangerous. This is now, we are so beyond crossing of a Rubicon that I don't know where we crossed it.
I think, JJ, that was the Rubicon. I think when they came right out and called it the Disinformation Governance Board, how about fuck you and the horse you rode in on? I don't even think we should accept this. I don't give that thing any legitimacy. Under what constitutional provision is it even legal? I don't think the right should even accept it. I think it should be ignored. I think it should be defunded. Where the hell are the Republicans on this, by the way? Has Trump said a word about this thing? I don't think he has.
Haven't heard. Yep, haven't heard from him. But the only people that I've heard talk about it are Josh Hawley, I think, mentioned something.
Rubio said something about
Rubio and Ron Johnson, which was sort of, you know, meh, but at least he said something. But this should be, these guys should literally en masse be walking out of Congress. And you talk about storming the Supreme Court. They should be storming the Supreme Court saying, you should just issue a frickin' edict saying we're not even going to trial with this. The edict from the Supreme Court is that this fucking board is completely illegitimate, and if you try to do something with this, we're, you know, whatever. But of course, when you give it, now all of a sudden it's like we talked about with mainstreaming pedophilia or gay marriage or whatever. When you put it out there, even something as outrageous as this is, and this is, you know, sort of couch, it's not even sort of outrageous in the sense of pedophilia, but at least it's couched in some sort of governmental thing to look out for your rights. When it's given this imprimatur of sort of pseudo-legitimacy that we're going to debate it in the greatest deliberative body in the world, you've lost right there, because it shouldn't be. It should be absolutely just rejected out of hand. And the fact that it isn't, that people aren't screaming in the streets, is really, it's kind of frightening. So
I'm stunned. It should be laughed out of court, as they used to say, but here we are.
Here we are. Hey, let's take a little bit of a break. We'll be right back. Touch of Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. Stay tuned. And we're back. CBD, you lost your microphone, but you had a rather salient point, so why don't you kick off with it?
Yeah, the button that says on-off. I don't know. I can't read very well.
It was the Bureau of Disinformation that actually clicked your button off. There you go.
I was accusing my two partners here of censorship. But at any rate, this Ministry of Disinformation is the highest expression of the nanny state. And I think it's very clear this is what they have been aiming for many, many years. And they're being very clever, in spite of the ham-handed way they introduced this, with this idiot 20 or 30 something fool with the bright red lipstick singing show tunes. I mean, it's embarrassing for people who think. But the way they're doing it is focusing on the Russian disinformation, and they're very, very carefully not talking too much about domestic, quote, disinformation, which of course is their goal, to shut down what they call disinformation, which normal people, which lovers of freedom and liberty, call speech. And this speaks to what I mentioned earlier in the podcast, that they never give up. And Michael illuminated that point. They never give up. They never stop. They never stop fighting. And Michael's article is extraordinarily important, because this really is the hill on which we must die. This is the end of the republic. If they are successful in creating a government system to control and to moderate and to guide speech.
Yep, then it's over. And I don't understand why there's not mass protests about this. I don't understand why the Republicans, as I was saying earlier, haven't stood up and one voice said this will not stand. I just don't understand it. We're losing our country right in front of our very eyes, and they're laughing at us as they twist the knife.
We were talking about Russia and Russian disinformation. Here's a little tidbit of information that sort of no one really noticed. As you know, Biden has put $33 billion in a supplemental budget for Ukraine, but somewhere buried in the paragraph here, I noticed this little tidbit. They're saying some of the spending includes an allocation of funds to the State Department, including funds to USAID to, quote, provide $8.8 billion to the Department of State for economic support and assistance to the people of Ukraine and other affected countries, including direct budgetary support as well as support for food security, blah, blah, democracy, anti-corruption, cybersecurity, counter-disinformation, human rights, atrocity documentation, and blah blah blah. So billions. So they're over in the Ukraine with Zelensky, and they're talking about going international with this Ministry of Truth nonsense. This is just. I can't even. I'm just beyond apoplectic. I can't. You know, I'm at a loss for words. But this is it. I mean, you talk. There is a hill. This is the hill to die on. I mean, I know we keep saying the hill to die on, but this is it. When they're going to sign.
I think it is it. That's what one of the reasons I named my piece after it, and illustrated it with Custer in the sense that that's the most famous hill to die on that we, you know, that we have in American folklore. But we've got to fight this, and now suddenly the Supreme Court thing will overtake this in terms of public focus. But these devils never stop. They're like rust, and they just keep on working at the foundations of the American Republic. One of the things about Russian disinformation I meant to say earlier is the left used to love Russia. They've been collaborating with them since 1923 when Lenin was a pup, for crying out loud. I mean, they supported Russia. They defended the Soviet Union, the Democrat Party. Ted Kennedy reached out to which was the Soviet premier.
I believe it was Andropov. And that's,
it was Andropov, yeah.
Yes, and that's treason. Andropov. That was a treasonous act.
No, it was treason, and Ted should have been
hanged.
Yes, hanged, as the Constitution says, to get around Reagan. They've always collapsed. So as an old Soviet hand myself, I'm always very suspicious of these. When I saw the dossier, I said the Russians wrote that dossier. Now follow me on this, guys. In order to point the finger at themselves, so they could then say, would we be so stupid as to point the finger at ourselves? This is a classic. This is the KGB 101 stuff. I saw it in East Germany. I went to East Germany for the first time in 85, where I encountered a little short Slavic guy named Vladimir Putin. What a surprise.
Wow.
There he was nearing the end of the Honecker regime in East Germany. I went to the Soviet Union for the first time in 86 with the great pianist Vladimir Horowitz and got a pretty good sense of things because let's see what happened. Chernobyl blew up while we were there. That was that was interesting too. And the KGB were dogging our footsteps. And I went continuously thereafter, right up until the coup against Gorbachev. So I've watched the Russians. I have many friends on both sides of the intelligence community aisle, and I know how they work. So this Russian disinformation thing, I'm very suspicious of all these people who are trying to foment this very curious double game they're playing against the Russians. And we brought up earlier the question of whether the Russians would use tactical nukes. The answer is yes. I was listening to a lot of people saying, Putin will never invade Ukraine. I said, of course he will. He's trying to take back what used to be historical Russian lands. He is a revanchist in the sort of true sense of the word. But now that what's left of the Red Army has shown to be so poorly organized, equipped, their morale is terrible, their leadership is awful. When Russians get pushed to the brink, they are very, very tough. As who found out about that? Oh, I think Napoleon and Hitler both found that out.
Yes.
The hard. So do we really want to watch this movie for the third time? That's my question.
Well, I was one of those people who thought that Putin would not invade Ukraine, not because I thought he was a moderate guy, but because I thought he could get what he wanted without having to invade, which I still think is the case. But and as for tactical nuclear weapons, I agree they would use them, but I don't think the conditions are nearly ripe enough for that use.
Well, let's remember this. When Napoleon really won the Battle of Borodino, the hard way, but won it, and then marched into Moscow, the Russians burned down their own goddamn capital city rather than let him winter there. And as a result, he had the original Bataan death march back to France. He went in with 3 million guys and came back with 50,000. I mean, I wouldn't fuck with the Russians if I was NATO. At this point, I wouldn't do it.
Well, right now, there are reports that Putin is about to undergo an operation for cancer. Mm. And his foreign minister is supposedly taking over. So that's kind of a curious development. He does look a bit puffy, but is this real? Is it disinformation? Is it a head fake? Is it who the hell knows? But yeah, I definitely would not mess with the Russians. I mean, yeah, this is horrible. An invasion is an invasion. It's aggressive war. Mm-hmm. Whatever his reasons were, I mean, it's horrible. But to literally now, you know, start waving Ukrainian flags all over the place, and to go there and to give arms and to give succor, and now you're training them, and there's even, I mean, Biden even let the cat out of the bag a couple of weeks back when he was with the 82nd or the 101st Airborne, saying, hey, you guys are going to have a good time over there. I know it. And I'm going, holy shit, are we really? I mean, it's one thing to go have a war with Saddam Hussein or with whoever, or go into Grenada and overthrow the president for life for this week.
Big deal.
You know,
right.
and big deal. We're talking about Russia. As degraded as they may be, this is Russia. They still have nuclear weapons, and they're still a power. I mean, it's insane.
They are a power, and I agree we need to tread lightly, but let's not pretend. NATO was formed primarily to prevent Russian tanks coming through the fold of the gap.
Right.
That's why it's there. And we do need to take Russia seriously, and we do need to push back. The problem is that Ukraine is 500 fucking miles. Yeah, I was saying Ukraine is 500 miles east of what we should be worrying about.
Yeah.
No, yes. What they did is wrong. I support Ukraine in its fight against Russia. I hope they win. I think the United States should do whatever it can under the table to support them. No troops and nothing overt. Michael's point, should we poke the Russian bear? No, that's a bad idea.
Let me tell you, this is an important point, and I don't think it's been made. When the wall came down, I was over by Potsdamer Platz there in the midst of all the chaos, because I knew East Berlin very, very well, having spent so much time. And I was with a friend of mine who was a Stasi agent, and with one of the KGB guys who operated under the cover of a newspaper correspondent for a youth newspaper in Moscow. And so with all this chaos going around us, we got 3 beers, and I said to them, well, you guys lost, you're buying the beer from now on. And of course, we had a little bit of a laugh about that, but as I mentioned with my reference to Putin, these guys all watched their country collapse, and they watched what they called the principal enemy, that's us, do it to them. And if you don't think there's a few guys in there just itching for payback, you're crazy. And if Putin, who is a smart guy, is out of commission, I don't know these other people. They may be completely bent on revenge or punching the capitalist foe in the nose. They didn't all become Jeffersonian Democrats the day after the Soviet Union collapsed. And these guys are still in a position of power, and they are very, very dangerous. And this blithering, senile, dope, corrupt Mick politician, who is currently the sham, I speak as a Jesus. Mick myself, as you can see of the background of my camera here.
Yes, sir.
He has no idea what kind of a fight he's about to get himself into, and he is putting our country in a very perilous position.
I think it's an excellent point. Be careful what you wish for. Who is behind Putin? Who comes next? And the answer is, as Michael just pointed out, who the fuck knows?
We don't know.
We don't know. And you're right. Are they going to put a couple of suitcase nukes in in Chicago and Washington? Well, Chicago would be bad. Washington, maybe not so bad. Or are they going to start launching? Who knows?
Can we draw up a target list for them? Just, you know, just among the three of us here? And just place,
oh, hell yeah.
Places we're willing to give up if they... I don't know.
Well, can we got to hold off for a month. I mean, I'm still in New York City, so if you could wait till the end of June, I'll be in Wisconsin after that. But, yeah, fire away, you know, Southampton, you know, Pacific
Heights.
How
about just Calorama?
And,
you know,
Calorama.
Getting back to Michael's article, he mentions the fact that a former president spoke in his usual fake eloquent manner about the fact that we didn't go far enough, that America didn't go far enough in censoring misinformation. And to me, that is a terrifying thing to hear a former president of the United States talk about gutting the First Amendment, thinking that the First Amendment is simply not important. Anyway, that was my segue back to Calorama as ground zero.
Right. Well, Obama, just to sort of put the dog on the he likes a nice hot dog or a dog, but just to put the to underscore that. Here's a man who believed in this notion of what was called negative rights.
Yeah.
He didn't believe in the Constitution as a charter of rights of the individual. He looked at it as a constraint on the government in its ability to control the individuals. Hence this notion of this insane notion of negative rights. No such thing as a negative right. It's, you know, that's what free speech is. Free speech is there, among other things, like the Second Amendment and other things, to tell the government no. Supremacy, and this was American exceptionalism, supremacy results ultimately with the individual, and government derives its just powers from the consent of the governed. I mean, my God, if I know that, and I'm, you know, whatever, well, there it is, the lack of knowledge of that basic truth. And if more people just understood that, they'd probably scratch their heads. Well, gee, maybe this whole notion of a ministry of information isn't such a great idea, or maybe the notion that they want to take my guns away from me isn't such a great idea. Terrible.
Yeah.
Well, Obama has no rooting interest in the United States of America. I went to high school in Honolulu, another one of my oddball biographical items. And so he was born, he would have been a little kid at the time I was in St. Louis High School in Honolulu, which is the second oldest private high school west of the Mississippi River. The first oldest is our hated rival, the Punahou School. And Barry got sent to the Punahou School. It speaks volumes about what his handlers were trying to do for him. That is the whitest school you can possibly imagine. In the Hawaiian Islands, when I lived there between 62 and 65, whites were a very small minority of the population. But the fancy school was the Punahou School, which had been founded by Protestant missionaries in the 19th century. And so they sent him to the one school where his skin color would have been different from everybody else. At my school, he would have fit right in because everyone was the same skin color as Obama, some sort of shade of brown, dark brown, with the whites as a very small minority. And I think that kind of shaped him. They put him in a position where he would deliberately be the other. And I wrote a piece in National Review when I was writing under the name of David Kahane, my crazy lefty screenwriter alter ego, which we might want to look up. It's called The Manchurian Candidate 3, and it's a little sketch for a screenplay about Obama and how he got where he was, which was, I wrote that on the night of the election when he was first elected president. He's got a very sketchy background, speaking of Russians and Soviet disinformation. And I will leave it at that. It's a conversation for another time. But the Americans don't understand that anti-Americans actually now have their own party. They always did. Let's face it, the Democrats were the ones that started the Civil War. And how un-American was that? Wanted to keep black people in slavery. How un-American was that? I mean, they're on the wrong side of every issue. But this is a party that's malevolent now and is quite open about it. And I thought that this disinformation governance board, well, you know, Orwell weeps. That's all I have to say.
The Democrats always started out with the veneer of being pro-American and rah-rah, and we love America and we love freedom and we love the Constitution. Now that's all. That pretext is gone long, goodbye. Long gone. The start of that was obviously, or maybe it was George McGovern, but it's certainly been long gone since then. Sure, when Barack Obama says, I want to fundamentally transform the United States, yeah. You don't love it. You don't love a country that you want to fundamentally transform.
No, that's important that's just... point, JJ. I mean, I'm 72. So when he said that, my ears pricked up and I said, I know exactly what he means. I know exactly what he means. And what he means is I want to destroy the country as founded and replace it with something else. And that's what fundamental transformation has always meant to these people. And unfortunately, most of our fellow citizens, or luckily for them, they're not as old as I am, and they didn't know, they hadn't heard that terminology all throughout the 60s. You know, I went to college between 67 and 71. That was the belly of the beast for the whole student revolutionary movement. And fundamental transformation was right up there. And there he was saying it with that big triumphant grin on his face.
And now, you know, you segue to current events, and we see the same people who love the idea of this fundamental transformation, but they view it through the lens of the champagne socialist. They want the trappings of a market economy. They want the riches that only a market economy and a liberal democracy can create in any country on earth. But they want it governed by a socialist dictatorship. And as we have learned over the last 150 years, it's simply impossible. And what they're going to get, if they get what they want, is a socialist hellhole, just like every other socialist country on earth. Yes. And if they don't get what they want, they're going to keep trying.
Well, they don't believe there's any consequences. They think everything will stay the same, but we'll have a different political system, right? That's what they think.
Yep.
And I think that the unique thing about the American version of it is they have Mexico as an example of what they really want, which is a very small group of caudillos and a huge peasantry.
Who are lily white, by the way.
Yeah, who are all, that's very important point. In Mexico, as in every country in the Southern Hemisphere, the lighter your skin is, the higher up the food chain you are perceived to be. So that the aristocracies of these countries trace their origins back to the Spanish. They don't want anything to do with the mestizo population, but they are very conscious about how European they actually are. Anyway, with Mexico, you have this very small minority of Pelosi's living in a giant peasant state like California, and essentially they're parasites on the backs of the people, but they subscribe to the notion that there's no enemies to the left, and they're certainly not going to hang themselves for being enemies of the state. So here we are.
I think what you both just described, you know, and to circle back again, Psaki circling.
Oh, I love her. Don't you? Isn't she just the best?
Piss,
I mean, God.
Piss hot. Peppermint piss hot.
Oh, my God.
Freaking horrible. She's like the bastard child of Chucky and Peppermint Patty.
Yeah, I think that's very good. I would have come to that conclusion myself, but you totally beat me to it. But I endorse it 100%.
Thank you, sir. But anyway, it all goes back to what you guys described of a state, which is basically the word is fascist. And that's Nazi Germany, where you have the trappings of private property. But the private property is really controlled by a handful of people from industrialists and the government. And they're basically, and even Hitler himself and their mission. This is why they lost in a way. One of the reasons why they lost the war was that they couldn't cope with Jewish capitalist industrialism, and they wanted this, you know, the craft guilds, and they wanted everybody to be peasants and go back to the land and be, you know, be farmers and live a natural organic life while they built, you know, industrialized a weaponry and attack the Soviet Union for Lebensraum. But here what we're doing is we're going to have that, except we're not going to be industrialized. We're going to go back to the Middle Ages when we get rid of our fossil fuels. So I don't know what kind of a society they think they're going to have, but you know, when everybody's freezing and starving, it's going to be something to watch.
It's going to be some agrarian utopia that they have in their fever dreams. Manufacturing will be offshore, and what will everyone do? I don't know. Web design, is that the goal? Who knows? It's an impossible economic plan.
Well, that's if I If I can get in a plug for our site, the-pipeline.org, we're entirely devoted to that subject, which is, what are you going to do when there's no fossil fuels? What we're looking to see, Europe is suddenly waking up saying, oh, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't have, Germany, for example, decommissioned all of our nuclear plants. Hey, maybe we shouldn't be dependent on the Soviet Union for oil. In my beloved second home of Ireland, which you, as I said, you can see out there on my video screen here, they want us to stop digging up turf, which is what heats the houses in Ireland. They want us,
peat.
Yeah, the peat. It's, we call it turf, and it comes out of these bogs and it's cut and it's, and then it turns into little sort of chunks and you burn it. And it's not terribly warm, but it's what the English left us after they completely raped our country for 1,000 years. And they don't want any more. They want you to not be able to build a new house with a chimney because you're polluting the Ireland, which comprises, you know, some minuscule percentage of the world's landmass. It's a little dinky island. Thinks that we can somehow affect the climate of the planet. This is how far gone we've become in Ireland. And everyone needs to wake up. Europe has, Germany has coal coming out its ears. So naturally, the left has forced them not to use it. As I say, it's a suicide cult, and they're just trying to take the rest of us down with them.
It's the hubris of the left. They think that they can perfect man, they can perfect the earth. And the earth laughs. Because you know something? Next winter in Ireland, it's going to get cold.
Look, how about this summer? It's always it's always cold in Ireland. That's the whole point.
Well, hopefully with all this earthquake activity going on underneath the ice in Antarctica, perhaps a super volcano will be blowing up, and we won't have to worry about any of this thing ever again.
We're done. Yeah.
There we go.
So we're running a little bit long, but before we adjourn, I would like to talk to Michael about someone I loved for a very, very long time, and that is Terry Teachout. I used to read Commentary magazine. I would read his pieces and commentary occasionally, and they always fascinated me because the idea of a music critic was something that was anathema to me. It was, you know, don't be silly, it's music, you know, you don't need a critic, you either like it or you don't. But he when I was much younger, he pointed me in the direction of thinking about music and art and theater in a perhaps a more sophisticated way. I'm just curious what you thought of him.
Well, I never knew him. He, after I left Time, I was at Time for 16 years as the classical music critic of Time. And then when I moved to Germany in 1989 and basically never came back, so I gradually spent the next few years writing as a contract writer for Time. And then after I left for good, once I published my first novel, Terry filled in for me at some points. I think we would have been friends had we ever met. We didn't. But as you pointed out about him, and what I've tried to do in my own career is show people the arts are terribly important from a historical point of view. When I wrote Devil's Pleasure Palace and The Fiery Angel, there's an awful lot in there about Milton and about Faust and about Wagner. You know, I'm a big fan of Jacques Barzon's Darwin, Marx, and Wagner. Book about the 19th century, the three most influential people. And I've tried to link these historical events and in an artistic context so you can see what the artists were thinking about them. So I've always said biology is the field for science, and the inner workings of the heart and the brain are fields for artists. And I believe that to be totally true. And again, with this new book that I'm doing, I'm going to continue to use the arts as a measure. That's why I'm starting, for example, with the Iliad, because not only is it our first historical document, it's our first great work of art. And the West is defined by this one great epic poem that has set us on the course of several thousand years. So I didn't know Terry. I was an admirer of him. I was sorry when his wife died, and then he died not too long after that. But it was nice to have an ally in him, even though we never met.
Well, the Ministry of Disinformation is now going to order your copies of the Iliad burned.
Yes, it did.
In front of your eyes. And then of course, like as Heinrich Heine or Goethe warned us, will be burned right not long after that, along with the Pete Bond.
Yes.
Gentlemen, I think that brings us to the conclusion, unfortunately, of a fascinating and wonderful hour of conversation and a warning about what the hell is going on in this country. J.J. Sefton here for CBD and Michael Walsh. Gentlemen, thank you for being here, and we'll see you again real soon.
Thanks for listening, folks.